It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. What's your take on avant-garde jazz? How about punk rock or sound art? A lot of modern music skirts the line between beauty and ugliness. It challenges us to listen differently. In fact, it's hard to think of any pioneering music that didn't inspire outrage at first. For example, in the early 20th century, as visual artists started experimenting with abstraction and surrealism, musicians were experimenting too. David Stubbs is the author of Fear of Music, Why People Get Rothko But Don't Get Stockhausen. Jim Fleming asked him why it seems like avant-garde music doesn't get the same respect that avant-garde visual art does, even though they both got started at the same time, the creative days of the 1920s.
Yeah, and I think they both came from the sort of same sort of wellspring of kind of cultural energy, and at a certain time, the dawn of the 20th century. Now, there was a sort of synergy at the time, and people like Schoenberg, you know, Arnold Schoenberg, and Kandinsky, the painter, they almost like recognized each other as kindred spirits. Kandinsky looked at Schoenberg and think, well, yeah, that's what I'm doing in painting. And Schoenberg looked at Kandinsky and said, yes, and vice versa.
Didn't Schoenberg and Kandinsky even promised to work with each other at one point?
They did. They were going to have some sort of synergized event.
Actually, I'm beginning to wonder whether we simply haven't listened enough to avant-garde music.
Yeah, it is marginal. I think abstract art is easier to consume. That's one thing. I mean, it's, say, a sort of difficult canvas by a Rothko. You go to, say, the Tate Modern and see something like that, or Museum of Modern Art in New York or whatever, and it's within your field of vision. You can spend as much or as little time in front of it as you please. It isn't kind of all enveloping. Music, of course, it's not like that. Music, say a piece by Stockhausen, you might be there for 90 minutes. You're in for the long haul.
Right. Well, I was thinking about it and realizing that when I see a piece of art that I don't understand, I can look at it, close my eyes, think about it, look at it again. You don't have that experience with avant-garde music because it is all around you. It's almost as though it interferes with your ability to think about it.
Yes, in a sense. I mean, you said it, you know, you can close your eyes. Of course, you have eyelids and you don't have earlids. And
right.
Yes, music, you know, has that kind of possibility of being distressing and invasive, especially people like Stockhausen. Sometimes he would arrange the speakers for sort of pieces that he did. It wouldn't just be something that was just in front of you, coming at you in front of you. He would arrange it all around the auditorium. So the music is coming at you from all sides. And it may be that goes back to kind of very early sort of caveman days or whatever, where any sort of sudden noise, unexpected noise, is going to sort of strike fear into you. And I think that probably is still the case for people now. And of course, music can sometimes have that distressing, invasive effect, and especially avant-garde music, because it's inherently informally, it's meant to be kind of surprising, unexpected, coming at you from somewhere unexpected.
But I want to go back to those early days in some ways, because there was a fuller range than I think we recognize now. Edgar Reyes, who wrote Amérique, which is not as disturbing, if you will, as Stockhausen or as Schoenberg. It's new and it's different and it challenges you, but it is not as random, I guess.
Well, that's right. I mean, that work, Amérique, it was written, it was about 1918, that sort of time, 1918, 1921. I think he sort of spent some time over it and then eventually revised it. Within that piece, you get a sense of the transition of music from the 19th to 20th century almost, because it starts off in a very sort of Debussy-esque, Stravinsky-esque sort of way, in the sort of dawn of the piece, as it were. But then all of a sudden, you know, the music suddenly erupts with these kind of very vertical crescendos, very American, very New York, almost like skyscrapers kind of emerging music, whatever. That sense of kind of new urban contemporary 20th century beginnings, and it really reflects a sense of America in a way that classical music really hadn't done at all before, not even really people like Charles Ives as such. But of course, the big thing we've got is the sirens. You get these kind of sirens wailing through, and obviously they're kind of, you know, he had his window open in his apartment near the Hudson River as he was writing it, and these sounds would come wafting in through his window. And there's a couple of things going on there. One, it's the idea of, like, which I think is at the heart of the avant-garde project, as far as I'm concerned. It's collapsing the walls between art and life. You're getting actual elements of life incorporated into the music in the way that Picasso incorporates, like, sort of clippings of Le Figaro in collage pieces and stuff like that. And then also you've got the idea of the pitch. This pitch incorporates the element of noise into music, something way beyond the whole sort of 12-tone system, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you think people would find it more approachable if they could think about it in visual terms?
Possibly. It's curious. I think that people accept a great deal more visual chaos than they do oral chaos. Another reason I think people have problems with avant-garde music is that they think it's like a kind of cryptic crossword or something like that. They think that they have to decipher something. And you actually don't. It's not like some sort of complex mathematical or algebraic formula rendered in sound. It's simply a case of being receptive to the idea of sounds not becoming, you know, sort of following the kind of normal orthodox pathways or whatever. It's really not necessarily about having to kind of interpret anything.
Brings us to Stockhausen. Stockhausen really made his breakthroughs in electronic music. One of his most famous works is called Kontakte.
Kontakte, yes.
Kontakte. Can you tell us about that?
Which means contacts. Well, yes, it was written about 50 years ago. He arranged it so that, like, the audience is in the centre and the music comes to them via four channels, which are arranged, like, in speakers, where in each kind of corner of the sort of square within which the audience is sitting. And even at one point, he uses some sort of rotation table at one point, so he had all these various mics in which he could kind of, like, fling even other sounds at the audience as they kind of listen to it. So it goes back to what I was saying before. It's the idea of the way it's constructed allows for sounds to come from absolutely any angle, take any kind of sort of shape or duration or pitch or intensity or whatever. I mean, in fact, Stockhausen, I think he actually functions as a composer better than, say, other people working in electronic music or music concrete, because I think he has a kind of innate sort of symphonic sense, a great innate sense of drama.
David Stubbs' book is called Fear of Music. 60 years after those avant-garde composers of the 1920s, some Japanese musicians followed in their footsteps, exploring the outer reaches of sound with what's called noise music. Philosophy professor Paul Hegarty's written a history of Japanese noise music. Steve Paulson asked him about when he first heard the new sound.
In Nottingham in the UK in 93, I'd say, and I look at this beautiful album called Anti-Monument by Mertzberg in a cardboard, very long cover with stuck-on pictures of planes and things falling apart.
Mertzberg is a Japanese noise maker.
Right, it's the working name for a guy called Masami Akita. And I got that home, and it was just banging and clattering and noises. This is good, are you allowed to do this? So at a personal level, it was my way in to another level of strange music, way beyond the kind of industrial music that was then in vogue, like Ministry and Nine Inch Nails and so on. Then it turned out there's tons of this stuff out there, and the 90s saw a huge explosion. So I'm going to work backwards. I'm going to start with the 90s. The 90s is when it really became a sort of pure thing, where Mertzberg gets louder and louder. The rock bands like KG Hino's, Fushitsusha, bands like The Ruins start in the 90s. And there's this drive, kind of like an arms race towards extreme volume and extreme content at the same time. Prior to this, we can go back as far as the early 70s to kind of the arrival of free jazz, prog rock. I suppose those are the main ones into Japan, and heavy metal, right. So Mertzberg's favourite music is Black Sabbath and King Crimson, for example, and a lot of jazz. So what they were doing, and a lot of the musicians would kind of say this, is that for them, they didn't divide this music up into different genres. They were reading it as a different type of information. A problem is often raised of those of us writing about music in the West, that we're somehow reductive of another culture, in this case Japan, and maybe it's not all noise to them. And that's possibly true. But a certain level of reduction is not possible to avoid. And the Japanese musicians in the 70s and through the 80s were processing whole swathes of new Western music, very occasionally combining it with Japanese traditional music, but very occasionally, and sort of producing this sort of, well, why don't we just have more of this? Why don't we make the tracks longer? So Acid Mother's Temple, who do a lot of touring in Europe, so they turn up here at least once a year, They basically sound like hawkwind, but they're a lot louder. Every song is 25, 30 minutes or 25, 30 seconds long. So that would be a kind of typical strategy. They're not the noisiest, they're just rock music, really. But that's the kind of thing that was happening in the 80s, was taking every kind of genre and mixing them together, or perhaps stretching them.
Well, and then Mertzbow does some rather interesting things. I mean, for instance, in some of his pieces, he incorporates nature recordings into his music. I'm thinking, for instance, of the song Black Frog. What do you think he's trying to do there?
Well, I'm always trying to work out whether he has or hasn't incorporated them. There's a Seals album, which I'm pretty sure has Seals sounds in. There's a very good album that's come out called Dolphin Sonar. Well, for him personally, the bizarre thing for this music, which is essentially just kind of all the way through, is that he thinks this is political. So how is he doing that? That's the real curiosity to me. So in Dolphin Sonar, or the Frog one that you mentioned, the Seals album, there's other ones about other sea wildlife. Just to have them in the titles and to get people thinking, I think the noise music creates a space for people to reflect on that without directing the way in which you think. Now, sometimes on the cover it will say, this is how to get in touch with PETA or organisations against whaling or this kind of thing. So there is that side of it. Well, if you listen to the actual music, it's hard to tell whether this is supposed to depict the terrible time dolphins are having, or is this the beauty of nature. So firstly, you get this space to think about that. Then you're trying to read for content. You're saying, well, what's he saying about the frogs? What's he saying about the dolphins? Well, we don't really quite know what the answer is there. But overall, you get this nice, pleasing effect, I think, of awareness of the kind of random and incredible, exuberant creativeness of nature. So you get a very positive image of nature, I think, out of the sort of endless chaos that he's happy to put in front of us.
Because I would think that almost by definition, we would say that nature itself cannot create noise. Noise is something that only humans can create. Would you say that's true?
Largely, noise is some kind of judgment. So you need a system of meaning, you need systems of language with which to compare the thing you're calling noise. But I would think, pushing it slightly, but in a way consistent with Mertzbow, I would think that any animal that has worked out a system of sound processing has things it regards as noise, and noise would be the threatening things, like a hunting animal or something.
Mm-hmm. Now, is part of Mertzbow's project to subvert our ideas of what music is? Is he creating an anti-music, but yet somehow it's connected to music as well?
Yeah. It is an anti-music in the same way that the Dadaist Hans Richter wrote his book about Dada and called it Art and Anti-Art, and had the idea of anti-art as being something very positive, something that was a bit like art, that happened where art was happening, but was actually an attack on our ideas on art. So Mertzbow is doing that, for sure. But I think increasingly as he's gone on, it feels to me as a... it's more a case of a parallel universe. Like, this is a different world where music started out differently, where it didn't have the conventions. So I'm increasingly thinking in those terms of parallel sound universes, parallel ways of constructing meaning, for example.
Now, at the very end of your book, you talk about the difference between hearing and listening. What's the distinction?
Within sound art, John Cage has taken, and Pauline Oliveros as the kind of pioneers of listening, that if we're all listeners, we're all artists, and the whole world becomes artistic. Hearing, on the other hand, is what happens when you're more kind of subjected to music. Now, that could well be listening to popular music in a public location, but either way, something about it should not stop you listening, but make you alternate between listening and hearing so that you were doing something with it mentally rather than just turned into a vegetable. Simple answer is listening is logically processing sound, and hearing is the sound kind of being more active in its own right.
Paul Hegarty's book is called Noise Music, A History. When we come back, a sonic sidebar from sound artist Janet Cardiff And we'll hear from one of the godfathers of punk, Richard Hell. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking this hour about making and hearing music. And one place that new music is finding audiences is in galleries and museums. One piece in particular has won the hearts of people across the world. It's called 40-Part Motet and was created by sound artist Janet Cardiff.
Quite often when you're walking into the piece of motet, you start hearing the singers before you even enter the space. And so you're wondering, what is there? There's a choir in this room? When you walk into the room, there's stands with 40 speakers set up in an oval around the space. Each one is a separate singer. So you really get a sense that that speaker somehow has the spirit or the ghost of this particular singer, an absent person. And it's quite fascinating to watch people because they sort of walk in quickly and all of a sudden they go into slow motion and their faces have this sense of, oh my goodness, what is this? And then they slowly walk into the center of the oval and they stand there. You can follow the music as it goes from one choir to another and to another. You can hear it moving around in a sculptural way. I just love the feeling of sound coming from one side, then another, crosses over you to another. And so all those sound waves hitting your body, it's quite an effect. You see people and they do burst out crying. Or they just sit there, and they sit there maybe for two versions through. And I remember watching a three-year-old conduct them, the whole choir, which was wonderful too. And people lie on the floor. There might be 20 people in this space, but they're all staring into somewhere, whether it's an interior space in their minds. I think wonderment in our work is something that we really concentrate because we love to experience it and we make work so that we can feel it. Many of our pieces have this sense, whether it's through trickery of technology or playfulness, it gives you a sense of, wow, how did they do that? Or all of a sudden you realize that you're in one space in your mind and in physical reality, you're all in different spaces and your mind kind of goes through this point where it can't concentrate, and so it goes into a state of wonderment, I think. And that is very important to me because I'm almost political in my views that the art that I want to create should be transcendent.
If you want to hear Janet Cardiff's 40-part motet in person, you can catch it this fall in Atlanta at the High Museum of Art. And if you want to hear our extended interview with Janet Cardiff about music, sound, and wonder, you can catch that on our website at ttbook.org. A couple of years ago, Maria Schneider had already won two Grammys for compositions that straddled the worlds of jazz and classical music, but she'd never used lyrics in her work. until she ran across the poems of former poet laureate Ted Kooser. I asked her about getting inspired to set his words to music.
Well, I had been on the road in Europe with my band, and a person in my band, Ingrid Jensen, a wonderful trumpet player, she had a podcast, and there was a poet on it that I fell in love with. His poetry felt like home. For instance, you know, the poem about walking by flashlight at 6 in the morning. Yeah, it's so beautiful, you know. And suddenly this flashlight, who would think a flashlight could all of a sudden become so poetic, and seeing the circle of light as the moon on a leash.
My circle of light on the gravel, swinging side to side.
I don't know what it is. That poem always makes me feel like I want to cry. And it's not a sad thing. I don't know why it makes me want to cry. It's so sweet.
Well, he wrote most of these as he was recovering from treatment for cancer, so there must have been a lot of sadness, a certain amount of grief went into these.
Yeah, and I think also a deep, I think he wrote that poetry as he felt himself kind of coming back into the world, you know, and slowly recovering, somehow feeling like he wanted to write again. And I think there probably was just this huge sense of gratification for life.
So what did you do when you sat down to set these texts to music?
I don't know. This was probably the easiest music for me to write ever because I love the poems so much. You know, walking by flashlight, I thought, I want something that just, you know, in the chords and the piano, just feels like it's walking, you know, and the straight beat. And that piece, it came out so easy. It wrote itself. It was like a pop tune or something.
With you about beauty. Your music is so often really lyrically beautiful in a way that feels unusual, maybe sometimes even slightly risky. I mean, I guess I'm thinking that after modernism, you know, beauty became kind of a suspect quality in art.
Oh, yeah.
You know, even an obsolete quality. So I'm wondering where you find the beauty in music, and do you ever worry that you're writing something that's too beautiful?
Oh, it's an interesting question because, you know, when I was in college at the University of Minnesota, at that time in the classical world, beauty was this suspect thing. And I really kind of ditched the classical world because there was no room for that. Mm-hmm. And I found that the jazz world was so open-minded. And then I went to Brazil and I discovered a culture where music is the center of life. It's like sustenance, and it's full of joy, and it's full of unabashed beauty. You know, there's a thing about writing beauty. Maybe it's like Ted's poetry. You know, you can write something that's accessible and beautiful, but it feels like fluff. It feels vacant. It doesn't feel smart.
It's like
and
sugar without anything.
Yeah,
more.
Without substance. And then there's a certain kind of beauty that grabs you and has a complexity underneath.
Where do you go to find that ravishing beauty?
I feel it. You know, I feel it in my bones. It's like, I think that's the mystery in art.
Well, it's interesting that you said you feel it in your bones physically. And I was thinking some of the most beautiful and even uplifting music, I'm thinking in particular about your Grammy-winning CD, Concert in the Garden. Some of that you composed during a really difficult time, shortly after you'd been diagnosed with breast cancer. I'm curious, did the experience of dealing with cancer and a changed relationship with your body affect the way you wrote music?
Yeah, so I get so scared to start something new. It's like facing the unknown. It's just horrible. And I had this big commission for jazz at Lincoln Center, and I was scared. And then all of a sudden this thing came up. I was supposed to be working on this music, and suddenly I had breast cancer, and a very dear friend of mine was dying of it. And I was such a mess, and I said, okay, I'm going to call the Wynton Marsalis people tomorrow and just tell them I'm pulling out. I can't do this. They'll understand. And I was sitting there, and I was so full of fear. And the only way that I could calm myself down was I went over to the piano, going to the music purely as an escape for myself. And suddenly, all of a sudden, I was writing down music, and I felt like I was bouncing on these horrible waves of the ocean. But all of a sudden, I was in my own world making beautiful sound, and it felt like a submarine going underneath, and the storm was above me, and I could see it and think about it, but it wasn't shaking me. And I think it's probably the most powerful piece I ever wrote.
Such a wonderful ear for finding the sounds that connect with what soars inside us. And so maybe it's not surprising I read that you also have a huge passion for birds.
Yes, that's just the most fun thing in my life. I love it.
Have you ever used any actual bird song in a piece?
I have, yeah. There's a piece called Cerulean Skies on my Sky Blue album, and I put in the real call from the Macaulay Library at Cornell of the Cerulean Warbler, which is it's not on the endangered list, but it probably should be or will be soon.
Have you ever actually seen one?
Yes. As a matter of fact, in Central Park, some guy said, hey, there's a cerulean over at 87th Street. And I said, what? And sure enough, there were these little oak trees along the street, and all these birders lined up. And for a whole day, from morning until evening, this cerulean warbler was flitting from, tree to tree, very low. And I went back at 7 in the evening. There were no more birders, but the bird was still there, and a cop drove by, and he said, is this where the famous bird is? And I'm like, yep, that blue bird up there. And it was amazing, So I thought it was the cerulean coming to personally thank me for writing Cerulean Skies. That was my interpretation.
Oh, wow. Well, on behalf of all your fans, thank you for the such beautiful music you've given all of us.
Oh, thank you.
Maria Schneider's album Winter Morning Walks won 4 Grammys last year. There's another genre-bending musician who's thinking literature these days. Richard Hell's got an autobiography out. In case you forgot, he's one of the people who started the musical movement that would eventually become punk. Steve Paulson started his conversation with Richard Hell by asking him to read from I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp.
I remember making some promises to my adult self when I was still a kid. I promised not to forget how arbitrary and unfair adult rules are. I wanted to have a life of adventure. I didn't want anybody telling me what to do. I knew this was the most important thing, and that all would be lost if I pretended otherwise like grown-ups did.
Oh, that is a great passage. Thank you. And what I find so striking about your memoir is how you stayed true to that vision. I mean, you created a life for yourself that challenged all kinds of authority figures, all kinds of social rules. But I have to say, you must have been a handful for your parents.
Yeah, in retrospect, I kind of feel sorry for my mom, even though, on the scale of delinquency, mine was pretty minor.
One thing that's striking is as I was reading about yourself as a teenager, as far as I could tell, you really didn't play music then. I mean, considering, you made your name later on as a seminal figure of the punk movement, but I mean, you weren't in garage bands. Was music a big part of your life when you were growing up?
No, not any more than for anybody else, but it was a great period for music. I think that was important because, I mean, once I did start a band, it was partly out of frustration with the horrible stuff that was on the radio at that time later. In the mid-60s, it was the music was really the kind of teenage news, you know. It was about real life, and, you know, it says things to you about what the world was like that you weren't hearing anywhere else. Those early Electric Dylan stuff or crazy Rolling Stone stuff like Paint It Black or Who's Driving My Plane, you know, the music of the band sort of showed you a wider world.
Yeah. Well, you have a great passage where you reflect on the rock music of your time and especially what it means to be a rock and roll star. Could you read that?
I remember Rainy Weather with the Aftermath LP by the Rolling Stones playing in someone's room off the common area in my dormitory. Stupid Girl, Under My Thumb, I Am Waiting. The record was so ragged and tinsely and expert and full of personality, cavernous and wise ass. The Rolling Stones came up with good titles, too. Aftermath. Who would have guessed that that word had the gore, the avalanche feeling it does? It seems like an innocuous word, but no, isolated, it's ominous, and it's about achievement, not an aspiration, but an accomplishment, specifically a serious crime or other disaster. It's mass killings and terrible deceptions that have aftermaths. I didn't buy into the mythology of rock and roll bands, though. As I said, the music was just a common feature of the environment. I wasn't a fan. The style of some of the groups was exciting, but the musicians were people who had taken a chance direction into music. I still prefer that angle on it, the way it is when a band starts out. Half the beauty of rock and roll is that anyone can do it, in the sense that it's not about being a virtuoso, but about just being plugged in a certain way, just having an innocent instinct and a lot of luck.
So there you were, a rebellious kid. You didn't fit in 1966. You just dropped out of high school, moved to New York. What were you looking for?
Well, I was looking for, you know, an arena. I was an aspiring poet. And New York was the center of the world for every kind of doing things well, period.
You hooked up with your old high school friend, Tom Miller, who later changed his name to Tom Verlaine. What was the connection between the two of you?
I guess what we had in common was a kind of sense of humor, sort of perverse and Martian, and an interest in art, writing, music, especially sort of obsessed, compulsive kind of art making. A lot of what was exciting to me about switching to rock and roll was how rock and roll had all these means of communication apart from simply the writing and performing of songs. For instance, hair. I mean, hair's been really important in rock and roll from the beginning.
And you had very distinctive hair. You had that spiky hair.
And your clothes and the way you behaved on stage and what your interviews were like and what the album cover looked like, what the posters looked like.
So there was a whole style that you were, it sounds like you were trying to create. And you had your ripped clothes, the safety pins, as well as the, you know, the spiky hair. What were you trying to communicate?
Well, you know, just the same way that my writing tried to express what was going on inside me and my perceptions of the world, I wanted all those other media, all those other means to do the same. It was about, you know, putting your insides on the outside.
So you and Tom Verlaine started your own punk band, which soon morphed.
It wasn't a punk band.
Well, later.
They weren't calling bands punk when we started.
Well, then it became the band known as Television.
Yeah, and you'd get a lot of arguments from people about whether or not Television was a punk band. But when I was in the group at the very beginning, it was a lot more like what people ended up calling punk. And the kind of attention that we got was about those qualities, for sure.
How would you describe that? I mean, what were those qualities? And we're talking early 1970s, especially the music around the club, CBGB in Lower Manhattan. What was that was happening there?
What was different about us and about many of the bands that then started centering around CBGBs was that it was spare, cut down, fast, short songs that were often angry, but also with this lyrical feel to them too, were about real life, you know, returning real life to rock and roll, the kind of real life that was in it when I was a kid, defying authority by speaking the truth to it.
You have a great passage in your memoir about the power you felt creating music and kind of about this whole scene we've been talking about. Could you read that?
The power and beauty of it was unimaginable until then. It can't be overstated, that initial rush of realizing, of experiencing what's possible as you're standing there in the rehearsal room with your guitars and the mics turned on. And when you make a move, this physical information comes pouring out and you can do or say anything with it. It was like having magic powers, the ability to create action at a distance. The sounds that came from the amplifiers were absurdly moving and strange. The variety of them so wide in view of the fact that they came from flicks of our fingers and from our vocal noises, and the way that it was a single thing, an entity, that was produced by the simultaneous reactive interplay of the four band members combining various of their faculties. We were turned into a sound, a flow of sound. It was like being born. It was everything one wants from so-called God. The joy of it, the instant inherent awareness that you could go anywhere you wanted with it, and everywhere was fascinatingly new and ridiculously effective. It was like making emotion and thought physical to be undergone apart from oneself. And every moment had that surging astonishment and pleasure, even if in the service of anger and disgust, as it often was, of anything being possible to make happen. It was like creating the world, and the feeling could never quite happen again, or be sustained anyway, because familiarity and habit take the edge off.
Richard Hell's autobiography is called I Dreamed I Was a Very Clean Tramp. Coming up, we turn from music to history, with a look back to 1914 and the beginning of World War I. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hello, I'm Terry Eagleton. I'm the author of a book called Why Marx Was Right. My dangerous idea, if you like, is that the humanities, at least the humanities as we know them, may be dying, maybe in fact dead on their feet, globally speaking. Our society has less and less time for the kinds of values which they incarnate. And what we're witnessing, I think, historically, is a momentous moment in which a very long and honourable tradition in which the humanities and education and the universities have behaved as a centre of critique of other sorts of social practices, other sorts of social institutions, is now almost over. I think that is extremely alarming, because the humanities, however ineffective, however separate, however idealist they may have been, have always tried to have that bearing upon the wider society, to bring it to task, to hold it to responsibility. Now, what we're seeing globally in universities throughout the world, and I spend most of my life travelling from one to the other, is the utterly boneheaded and philistine attempt to instrumentalize the humanities so they become merely functional for advanced capitalist means, and anything that doesn't fit in to that ludicrously narrow scheme is simply thrown out. I live in Ireland and I teach sometimes in Britain, and from where I come from, whole departments of philosophy, of literature certainly, it's pretty clear that there are some long-term plans not just to delimit them but to close them down entirely, because they don't fit the Philistine hard-nosed priorities of a society that really wouldn't recognise a humane value if it fell into their lap. I think it's a sort of culmination of a long process of what you might call managerialization, whereby an older situation in which the humanities were not so pressurized, maybe they were rather marginal, certainly, rather quaint, rather ineffective, but now I think the priorities of capitalism are so strident and so commanding that anything that doesn't, as it were, have an immediate functional value, what they call in Britain impact, the impact of humanities, which is measured in ludicrously narrow terms, so that the humanities are involved in long-term meditations, you know, upon quite fundamental issues, issues which in the end are very vital to the quality and health of civilizations. And I think that, you know, now advanced capitalism has become so rampant, so concerned, so assured that there is no other kind of logic in human life, that it's riding roughshod over them in a way that, as I say, does actually presage their possible disappearance.
That's literary theorist Terry Eagleton's dangerous idea. Want to hear more? You'll find a whole slew of ideas to shake up your thinking on our website, ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I. And with conflict flaring up around the globe, we're wondering what started the war that was supposed to end all wars. A couple of months ago, Jim Fleming sat down with historian Max Hastings. He's written a shelf full of books about the Second World War, but only recently turned his attention to World War I. He told Jim Fleming why.
There were lots of things about the First World War, and especially about 1914, that absolutely fascinated me. As you know, for the last century, there's been a huge controversy about responsibility for what happened in 1914. And also, there's a very widespread view that the two world wars, the First and Second, belong to completely different moral orders, that whereas the Second World War was the good war, the First World War was the bad one, that no cause could possibly have justified the sacrifice. And I believe that there was a cause at stake in the First World War, that if Germany had won, it would have been a tragedy for Europe. And sure, the outcome of the First World War proved to be terribly impermanent because the Germans had to be fought all over again a generation later. But if we'd lost, it would have been a pretty nasty Germany that ended up in control of Europe and, dare I say it also, menacing across the Atlantic the United States.
Did you think at all when you began looking at the First World War that you might be prejudiced by what you knew about the Second World War in trying to go back and re-examine?
We're all prejudiced in different ways. We're all carrying a great baggage of opinions of one kind or another. But I think that one of the things several thoughtful commentators have noticed in recent years, we're incredibly triumphalist about the Second World War. And I sometimes say, sure, we were the good guys. But when you remember that the United States and Britain in the Second World War had to get into bed with a tyranny of Stalin's Soviet Union, which was every bit as evil, morally indistinguishable from Hitler's Germany, then maybe the whole thing becomes a bit more confusing. But in the end, most of grown-up history is about saying not which is absolute good, but which is relative good. And I'm convinced that the Allied cause in the First World War, as in the Second, represented relative good. Most books either talk about how the war came about or tell the military story. And what I wanted to do was to try to answer the question so many people ask, what happened in 1914?
Let's talk a little bit about Serbia, if you will, because there are those scholars who believe that Serbia was really the root cause of the war.
I don't think that any of us who write about this, or anybody sensible who writes about this, is going to be arrogant enough to say my view is the right view of 1914, because the evidence is so confused and contradictory. Now, some scholars do consider that Serbia in 1914 was as much a rogue state as Iran is today, and therefore deserving of military retribution. And on the 28th of June 1914, a Serb, a subject of the Austrians, but nonetheless an ethnic Serb, shot and killed the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. And the Austro-Hungarians decided they didn't much like Franz Ferdinand, the Archduke who was killed, but they made up their minds that they'd had enough trouble from Serbia, and they were going to sort out Serbia once and for all and break it up. But Serbia was under Russian protection. Everybody knew it was under Russian protection, and I believe myself that it was very irresponsible of the Austro-Hungarian government, and more surprisingly and worse of the German government, who immediately offered them unconditional support for smashing Serbia, knowing that the Russians would almost certainly intervene, and this would mean a general European war.
Of course, we're looking back now from 100 years. It does sound as though accidental war was almost inevitable, but perhaps it was
I won't
inevitable.
Buy that, Jim, because I don't believe anything in history was inevitable. Every government believed that it was acting rationally. The Germans believed that it was entirely rational to support the Austrians in launching a war. The Russians believed it was entirely rational to prevent Serbia from being broken up. Everybody thought they were doing the sensible thing. And it seems to me that the Germans must bear most responsibility because they were the one nation that had the power to prevent it. All through July 1914, when this crisis was unfolding, if at any time the German government had stood back and said, hang on a minute, we wanted a local Balkan war to smash Serbia, but it's now obvious that we're going to have a European war, and if they just sent one message to Vienna saying stop, then the whole thing would have fizzled out. But instead, unfortunately, the German generals, they believed that they could win a war against Russia and its ally France. I mean, one thing that always I find absolutely fascinating about the whole story, if the Germans had not gone to war in 1914, they were doing so fantastically well industrially. Their economy was zooming ahead of everybody else's. But in those days, people didn't think that economics was for grown-ups. They measured strength simply by counting soldiers. If the Germans had not gone to war in 1914, their dominance of Europe by peaceful, industrial and economic means would have been absolutely invincible within 20 years.
It's, of course, impossible to hear you talk about this without thinking about modern ramifications. But let's stay in 1914 for a little while. Who was it in the German government that was pushing so hard for war?
It was mostly the generals who had to justify the fact that Germany had created the most formidable army in Europe. The view had been growing in Germany that there had to be a war with Russia sooner or later, and if it was going to happen, then let's have it sooner, because they thought their chances of winning in 1914 were better than their chances would be two or three years down the track. What we have to be clear about, I don't think the Germans wanted a big European war in 1914, but they did will a Balkan war. And one of the things that's to our generation almost incomprehensible is we think of war as the supreme horror to be avoided at all costs. But in those days, almost all the European powers believed that war was a sort of usable instrument of policy, that war had served Germany well, and they thought another one might do the same thing. Of course, one thing we also have to remember, some people have this funny idea that Europe, in the years before the First World War, was a time of sort of girls in crinolines punting on the river and archdukes with footmen with powdered hair and everybody living out this old-fashioned Viennese waltz time life. Well, it wasn't like that at all. We think today, in the age of the internet, that we're living in a time of rapid change. The changes we're going through was nothing compared with the changes that overcame Europe and the world between 1900 and 1914. First of all, terrific social forces. Everybody was on strike, the workforce demanding a larger share of the cake, revolution in the air in a lot of countries, a lot of monarchies tottering. The Wright brothers had only taken to the air less than a decade before. Electricity, the cinema, the telephone, the automobile, all these things were suddenly becoming quite commonplace. And nobody in that society, this ferment of ideas, you've got Einstein producing his first theory of relativity, you've got Bakelite, the first synthetic polymer being invented, all this unfolding, these huge, terrific social and scientific and industrial changes, and none of these statesmen and generals who've been born into the 19th century, the Victorian era, they were all completely outclassed by all this. They couldn't figure how to manage it. one has to have a bit of sympathy with all those generals and statesmen who were struggling desperately to cope with all this.
I have the sense, reading your book, that one of the pleasures for you was in researching the people who fought this war.
I never cease to be moved by the sort of stuff you come up with. I mean, the first real trench battle of the war, which was amid the mud of Ypres, as it was called, a town in Belgium, in October and November 1914, I was terribly struck. We think today of those words that are written on so many gravestones, rest in peace, as a cliché. But to those who went through those terrible, terrible experiences of battles like that, those words had a terrific meaning. And I'm always struck, in particular, a letter a Grenadier Guards officer wrote about a friend and comrade who was killed at Ypres. I'll read a little bit of it. "When I think of poor Bernard's utter weariness, I left him in his trench in the early morning and wished I could take his place. He was so done. I think of him now, at peace, away from all this noise and misery. And though it must be terrible for his wife, poor thing, it can't be bad for him, and must comfort her to know he can rest at last." And words of that sort had a profound meaning for millions of men who experienced the horrors of the First World War.
On both sides of the line, you'd think. Was there ever any chance, do you think, that it could have been a quick war?
No. There's a brilliant phrase of George Orwell's: the only way to end a war quickly is to lose it. Unless one side or the other collapses quickly, which occasionally happens in war. In the 20th century, when you had great industrial nations pitted against each other, an enormous amount of killing and dying had to happen before one side or the other could prevail.
Do you think, after all of the scholarship that you have done, that there are lessons we need to take to heart looking at the world situation today?
I'm certainly no pacifist. I do believe that we must be prepared to use force from time to time in defense of our national interests or our common interests, in the case of the United States and Britain. But gosh, we need to think an awful lot harder than we have done in the last 10 or 12 years about what wars we get into. And I do hope that the consequence of our very unsuccessful wars of the last 10 or 15 years won't cause the United States, or for that matter Britain, to start thinking again in isolationist terms. We've got to be willing to play a part abroad. But gosh, our leaders, we have to face it, have screwed up on a very big scale over the last 10 or 15 years. We've got to do better if we're going to use force abroad in the future.
Max Hastings' book about World War I is called Catastrophe 1914, Europe Goes to War. And that's it for this hour. But if you want more, you can dig through more than 10 years' worth of past shows on everything from salt to sex to science. Explore the archives on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today's show was produced with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Charles Monroe Kane, and Raymond Tungekar, and Will Hinkes. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.